Welcome to our Core Christi monthly discussion. My name is Rachel Pachta, and I'm the Director of Ministry for the Missioners of Christ. This month, I'm joined by my amazing co-hosts, Angela Whitehouse and Kate Harmeyer, as we discuss the middle chapters of The Great Divorce. We talk about the attachments, the different people that we see, the great insight, and the hope that we receive from the solid people, especially George MacDonald. We discuss what he says about heaven and hell, and also about how the light is the thing. So we pray that this discussion is fruitful for you. So without further ado, here is our second discussion on The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. Hey, everyone.
Hello.
Hi.
This is a little more like our start to recording. We're 27 minutes in press record. We've had our microphone dramas, our room temperature adjustments.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes.
You know, the new computer that has yet to be used before when podcasting situated. We're good.
We're good to go. We're good to go.
We are good.
Kate, you were talking about the unifying factor. Kick us off here.
Okay.
With the cigarette smoking doubter.
I love how we put that on him.
I don't think he's actually smoking a cigarette.
No, he doesn't.
No.
We're like, no, he's absolutely smoking cigarettes.
He's got a lean,
scrawny little guy, yeah, like a raspy voice.
He's got a raspy voice. Basically, he is Clint Eastwood. Like, yes. that's who this is right
if
now.
If we had to portray him in our movie of The Great Divorce.
Oh, he would be great. He would be fantastic. But yeah, so as we look at chapters 8, 9, and 10, this character's influence on the narrator extends into chapter 8. And I do think it is worthwhile to remind ourselves of his mindset as we like kind of enter this next section of his exploration of heaven, or as we learn to call it, the Valley of the Shadow of Life, I think, in this section, which is really cool. But he has, by his conspiracy theories, put into the narrator's mind that maybe he shouldn't stay or can't stay for the very first time. And so he gets a little bit of like a contact depression. He starts to look at the raindrops and the bugs that are going by and to become like fearful of the space in a new way. And so his exploration, I think, is now just kind of clouded with a general suspicion and fear as he encounters the characters that we encounter in this section. One line that I thought was very poignant was where it says on page 58 in my book, "Terror whispered, this is no place for you." And it feels very much like a whispering in the ear, almost like a, you know, a serpent in the garden sort of thing, that he's starting to doubt the intentions of the Lord or of this space and to kind of maybe take a few steps back on his journey.
I gotta say, maybe it's a little immaturity in me, but right after that it says, "I remembered also the lions." The first episode we're like, and then there were random lions.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting.
I just remembered also the lions.
Forget the bugs. There were lions.
Terror is whispering to me, and also I'm thinking about those lions. So I think that, you know what's interesting? Where it says, "This is no place for you." And then the first character that we meet is the lady who does not want to be seen. So it goes right into like this place here where he's starting to doubt and starting to kind of navel gaze a little bit and really introspectively thinking about like, you know, maybe I can't hack it here, maybe blah, blah, blah. And then here comes this woman running into the scene who's like, "Stay away from me. I would have never come here if I had known that you guys looked like this. And that I looked like this." There's this really powerful encounter between her and her chosen solid person who had come to meet her about taking her mind off of herself. Can you not think about yourself for 1 minute is what it boils down to. And it's almost like the C.S. Lewis character is kind of sitting here and worrying and about himself and whether or not he can hack it and like whether or not this is a place for him and him. And then he sees this woman and he gets to kind of, in a way, it's a moment of grace. Cause like he sees this woman and it's almost a reflection on the outside, in a way, maybe a feminine reflection on the outside of like, let's not dwell here. Let's not think about ourselves. I don't know if I'm maybe making too much of a connection between those two events, but it just seems intentional that right after he's starting to have this kind of dip in confidence in being there, mm-hmm. that he encounters this woman who is absolutely horrified that she's see-through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I like that connection there. I think what we see with him is he begins to almost, so he doubt enters, and then we see with her this shame. And with both of them, there's this, the idea kind of like self-pity too, like, especially with her, like, I'm not supposed to be here, or like, how could I be here while you all look like this? And there's just this inward navel gazing where she then becomes so focused on herself. And the thing that struck me with her character, I think it was that line that you were saying, Rachel, it's on page 62, when the spirit says to her friend, could you only for a moment fix your mind on something, not yourself?
Mm-hmm.
For me, thinking about just those words alone, and how often, even in my own life, in my own days, where it's just like, I'm getting frustrated at something, and it's, and I'm frustrated because I'm thinking about how it's affecting me, or I'm frustrated because selfishly I want an outcome to look differently and it doesn't. And just that question, could you for a moment fix your mind on something, not on yourself?
Yeah.
And how that plays into the spiritual life as well. But I don't, it was just really beautiful to see how she was so, just enveloped in this self-pity where she couldn't even look upward.
Mm-hmm. It seems that the characters in this section in particular, and throughout this encounter, like, they're taking themselves too seriously in a way, you know, and I mean that not in a flippant way, but in the sense of like, if they could, there's a section later where it says like, if they could just look at their errors and kind of laugh it off and keep going, it would be so much better. And they can't seem to look at themselves from the outside perspective to kind of just say like, oh, this wasn't what I expected, or I'm exposed here, but that's okay. They're saying it's okay. I can trust that it's going to be okay. I can go through this purgation. I can go through this shame and come out better on the other side of it. You know, she, the spirit that comes to her is not clothed. And she's like, well, I can't be here when you're dressed like that. And he's like, well, you see, I'm not even wearing anything. Yeah. And she's like, mm-hmm. You don't even know what I mean. Like, you know, she feels like almost like he's patronizing her in that moment. And she apparently put on her, like, her best outfit. So she was very well-dressed, but her finery, you know, looked like ghastly almost in comparison. And you just like want to pitch in some fashion and just be like, let yourself be seen in the light. And there is, when I say they take themselves too seriously, there's this turned in sort of heaviness about them, despite the fact that they're not solid. And there's this lightness about the solid people, despite the fact that they're substantial. They look back and they're like, oh yeah, 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 I had to go through this too, or I was even in a worse place than you were. Mm-hmm. But trust that this healing, though it may not feel great in the beginning, is the beginning of your salvation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. Like, it's almost like the ghostly people make too big of a deal out of themselves.
Yes.
And they're all kind of faced with this decision of whether or not they're willing to just stop thinking about themselves. I know we keep coming back to that, and we've repeated it like several times now, but that's really honestly what it comes down to, is like, if they're willing to not think about themselves and only behold the Lord in front of them, behold the one who is in front of them, rather than holding on to themselves and attempting to earn their way in.
Mm-hmm.
And with her, it's like, she's just so shocked that her very best of what she put together, that was so different from what she encountered with people who are unclothed, who are completely seen and completely vulnerable, and that's how they are solid.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just like, I would never forgive myself if I let myself be seen.
Yeah. I was going to ask you guys, do you think that there's a pride here with her, or do you think that it's a different type of sin? Like, is this underlying thing that she's experiencing Is that because of pride?
I think that the root of all of the people's attachments here is pride in some way, shape, or form. I think the root of all sin is pride when you break it down to, I choose my will over the Lord's. I know better than the Lord's way, in essence. And so, you know, this is a perfectionistic person who always put the right outfit on and was always, you know, found herself properly comported for the situations that she went into. And then she was just exposed. And I think back to Searching for and Maintaining Peace, you know, when it talks about, you know, when we stumble, when we sin, you know, we should not allow that thing to like, to make us spiral and spiral and spiral downwards, but rather just be like, of course, I'm a sinner. Thank you, Lord, for reminding me yet again. Thank you for keeping me from sinning worse. Please, you know, I need your grace. And let's start again. And with all of these characters, you see them, you know, seeing themselves in the light of day and being so shocked and horrified by what they look like.
In as a perfectionist, like that's what happens, is that we don't want to be seen as being vulnerable.
Yeah.
We don't want to be stripped
of,
you know, of the things that we hold on to and value, and this is who we are, kind of thing.
I got to read this section really quick. I think it gets at it perfectly. What we're talking about is page 60 and 61 in my version. There's probably a million versions of this out there, but it says, the solid person is speaking to her. She's the ghost woman is now saying, you know, I can't come out there. Everybody has solid bodies. Everyone's going to stare through me. He says, oh, I see. But we were all a bit ghostly when we first arrived. You know, that'll wear off. Just come out and try. But they'll see me. What does it matter if they do? I'd rather die. But you've died already. There's no good trying to go back to that. The ghost made a sound, something between a sob and a snarl. I wish I'd never been born, it said. What are we born for? For infinite happiness, said the spirit. You can step out into it at any moment. I tell you, they'll see me. Last part. An hour hence and you will not care. A day hence and you'll laugh at it. Don't you remember on earth, there were things too hot to touch with your finger, but you could drink them all right? Shame is like that. If you will accept it, if you will drink the cup to the bottom, you will find it very nourishing. But try to do anything else with it and it scalds. And you know, the man before this was a voice of kind of masculine despair in a way, all of these, you know, like, oh gosh, we couldn't even be able to interact in here. So we might as well turn around. And this is almost a feminine version of like, I wish I had never been born. I never, ever want to be seen. And it's that desire to just completely shut away and let nobody in, period. What do you guys think about that phrase, shame is like that? If you will accept it, if you will drink the cup to the bottom, you will find it very nourishing, but try to do anything else with it and it scalds.
It's a hard one, to be honest.
I
think it has to do with the fact that shame is only fruitful in so much as we take it in as something to nourish us and change us from the inside through grace. You know, that shame, when it is maybe not taken in that fashion of I am experiencing my insufficiency. I am experiencing who I am in my sinfulness for the purpose of being changed from the inside out. That's when shame can be something that's helpful. Whereas in some other less healthy contexts, it's something that hurts.
There's so many Garden of Eden images here. And one of them is she starts to hide in the bushes. And I think that she tries to go and contort herself so that she's hiding in the bushes so she can't come out and she can't be seen. Just like Eve, right?
Yeah.
Why are you hiding? Because I'm naked. Who told you were naked?
Yeah.
That serpent, right? So I think that instead, just coming out and being seen and realizing that, we're not as big of a deal as we made ourselves out to be, in a really good way. in a really good way, not in some kind of like demeaning, honestly, like kind of self-hateful way, which would really be, you know, not from the Lord, but instead in a way of like, just let yourself, all the good and the bad and everything about you, be seen by the Lord and be seen by your community, you know, mm-hmm. and embrace what's there, and he will redeem you, and he will do his work in you, and mm-hmm. you'll become solid.
I think it's like, you are not that special of who you think you are. And I like that line because it's like, yeah, it's not about who you think you are. It's yeah. who the Lord has created you to be, and making that distinction between who you actually are, seen before the eyes of our Heavenly Father.
Right. Because the ones who aren't thinking about themselves are the ones who are the most beautiful there, right? Mm-hmm. They're the ones who are the most solid.
Who have been seen by the Lord.
Like
it. And who have allowed the Lord to see them too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the beginning of healing. You know, you always wonder what would have happened in the garden if Adam and Eve hadn't hidden, but instead had sought, you know, forgiveness and contrition and reconciliation, and had let the Lord kind of see them as they were, what that would have looked like, you know. Mm-hmm. And I see in this very much, I'm glad you pointed that out. Can't believe I missed that obvious allegory there. But that in Eden, the first, you know, bad feeling that enters the world after sin is shame over the naked body.
Yeah.
And I think that in her, again, we see that base of pride, mm-hmm. That we see throughout all of the characters. I do enjoy at the end, there's just some unicorns, which again, we've got to just have a few
mythical creatures.
Yeah. Mythical creatures come on out. But later on, we hear, I think in the George MacDonald character that we encounter next, we hear him explain the unicorns. And he said he's seen people saved by those sorts of tactics, if you will, because it's startling, so much so that if you could catch someone out of looking at themselves and to look at something else, even in that one moment, would be an opening for someone to start the path of reconciliation or of exposing themselves to healing, if mm-hmm. they could literally just stop looking at themselves for 1 second.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
Yeah. I like that.
Like it.
So all should right. we start talking about George?
Meet George.
George. Yes.
The thing, everything's about to turn now, because now we meet C.S. Lewis's solid person, which the whole time, the first time I'm reading through this, I was like, okay, so I'm assuming someone's going to meet him at some point. We're not just going to keep looking at these other people. And then it's George MacDonald, who is a real person. Mm-hmm. You guys know. And he was the real, like, kind of beginning and cause of C.S. Lewis's conversion and his real life. So he chose George MacDonald because he's the person who in C.S. Lewis's real life woke him up out of his ghostly state. So I thought it was so appropriate that that's who he chose in this story.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know that. That's really cool.
Yeah, it becomes, you like, this is the point, chapter 9, where the book kind of turns and you start to see it as C.S. Lewis is like an a fantasy autobiographical reflection, and this narrator is him, or yeah. him visualizing what it would be like if it were him, and who would come for him, and what that would be, and of course George MacDonald enters in, and immediately the narrator dives into like, oh, I can trust you. I know I can trust you. You will tell me what's real. And so starts to ask him some very theological, philosophical problem or questions about the space that he doesn't understand. And so in chapter 9, a lot of what we get is kind of the nature of these spaces, heaven, hell, purgatory, time and choices, and how they play out in the scheme of eternity. There's a lot of great quotes in this section that mm-hmm. just are so thought provoking. Mm-hmm. One of which I thought was really maybe a good place to start. It's on 69 in my book, and it's just a very short one. And it says, good and evil, when they are full grown, become retrospective. Mm-hmm. And you start to kind of understand the nature of this place. Cause by this point in the book, I had a lot of questions like, okay, you know, like, so how long do people have a choice before they're, you know, frozen in time and the eternal decision is made. Isn't C.S. Lewis the Protestant? And this sounds a lot like purgatory. And a lot of these like angelic beings, you know, and all of this stuff. I always think C.S. Lewis, like the Lord let him, you know, die a Protestant so that Protestants would pick up his books and then convert to Catholicism because he's so Catholic in his writing. And his reflections on the way that there's a radical freedom in the heavenly space, that the freedom though is a true freedom, not a license to I do what I want, but a freedom to be who you are called to be without anything holding you back, like a freedom from bondage to any attachment that would keep you from being who God has called you to be. That is the true freedom that is in this space. And that plays out in each one of these different characters' decisions. And that heaven is this choice to walk towards the Lord and his will, even if it is exposing us to the light. And that hell is this choice to continue to walk away from the Lord and to choose your own will over his, because maybe it's slightly more familiar or comfortable.
From the page right before that was what I underlined. You call it the valley of shadow of life, and yet to those who stay here, it will have been heaven from the first. And you can call those sad streets in the town yonder the valley of the shadow of death, but to those who remain there, they will have been hell even from the beginning. It's the idea of right now, right here, and this, because this isn't like, this is a story about really like our lives, right? And so what are those actions that we're doing? Well, we're either on a journey one way or the other. It says, no future bliss can make up for it, not knowing that heaven once attained will work backwards and even turn that agony into a glory. Man, there's somebody who has been heavy on my heart over the last day. It was someone who I did mission work with when I was going to a Presbyterian church, and we spent the summer in Africa together. And I just learned yesterday that her husband of 5 years had died. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, it just hurt to think about her going through that suffering. And the thing is, she's such a faithful woman. And so like that aside, like, you know, she's just proclaiming like faith in the Lord and that he's still good and all of these beautiful things. But I went back and for a moment I just thought, why, Lord, why do some people have to go through this kind of suffering? Like, why has she had all of this dealt out to her already? And I thought then of this quote of like, if you look back, all of that temporal suffering was actually, you know, those who are in heaven will look back and see that even that was a part of the heavenly journey and that it wasn't for nothing. It wasn't like, oh, that was like terrible, that God even turned their agony and their sufferings, big or small, into something that was glorious and that birthed within their souls heaven. And it's really hopeful. It's really hopeful because right now we're seeing all these souls that we're assuming are turning away or these ghosts, you know, like that's kind of the stories that we've been dwelling in for the first part of this book. But I love that George MacDonald's giving this explanation of like, well, this is their life. They were always walking in this direction. They were choosing, their choices chose this direction that they're going in, this closed offness. And that's why it's always kind of like, dangerous to it's a healthy realization to realize that there's no tomorrow. So like whatever I'm choosing today is one direction or the other, right? And like, yes, we can fail, but like, am I open to mercy? Okay. Am I fostering virtue or vice?
Yes. It gives this like, so it is interesting that we're talking about the afterlife, but it does speak to our current decisions and the impact that they have. I was thinking as we were talking about how there is like an apparent freedom down in the gray town, which will become the valley of the shadow of death, which will become hell if you choose hell with your choices. And there's an apparent freedom where they can like think a house into existence and they can move wherever they want to go. And basically kind of do what they want to do. But everyone is so selfish down there that it never really materializes into anything productive. But there's an apparent kind of license or freedom down there, but it's one that continually like moves them away from the Lord and is insubstantial, right? And in heaven, and people who are choosing to walk that path, it is, you know, a literal step into the light. And it is this continual progress towards the mountains, and how we can ask those questions about our daily lives. Like, is this a choice that is taking me on a path that's in my control and it feels free, mm-hmm. but it's actually walking away from the Lord? Or is this choice, though maybe it involves some immediate suffering or discomfort, but in fact, it's a choice of stepping into the light, of letting myself be seen by the Lord, as imperfect as I may be, and being open to stepping with him into the person he's calling me to be. So yes, it does put choice again, like that radical freedom, like right in front of you. And to me, just continually ask, it makes me ask the question every time we encounter these ghosts and the solid people talking to them, to painfully look and see, like, in what way, where am I here? You know, what is the attachment that I see in this person, and where is it in myself? And it's shocking that even though the people may not look like your most apparent struggle or your most apparent, you know, sin, like certainly there are some that more than others resonate with me, but in each one of them, you can see something of yourself, mm-hmm. and it's a picture of your pride and your selfishness. And so I like how this reflection on eternity, kind of, Rachel, like you were saying, makes us think about how the choices that we're making today are steps towards one place or the other.
Yeah. I also thought of how hopeful this is, and how when we talk about heaven on page 70, he goes through a little bit of what you were saying, Kate, of the distinctions of hell and heaven. And he was saying how in hell you are kind of, it's a state of mind. And then he says, heaven is not a state of mind. Heaven is reality itself. All that is fully real is heavenly. For all that can be shaken will be shaken, and only the unshakable remains. And how beautiful it is that we are able to experience a tiny bit of that on this side of heaven. And I've had this experience like in prayer or something, where you have an encounter with the Lord and you say, I have never felt more fully alive than I do in this moment, or in this conversation that I just had with somebody. And that's just this glimpse of how real heaven is, mm-hmm. where everything is fully alive. And I don't know, it just fills me with so much hope. Like, this is our goal. Like, this is what we desire. And we are able to have, you know, just these glimpses of it here. And even when we do have those sufferings, and people who have gone through, you know, such suffering, and they're able to come out of it with this unshakable faith, they have encountered a glimpse of that reality.
Somehow, some way, every trial of our lives, if God willing, we make it to heaven, we will look back over it and we will say, I would do it again. Like, if not for that, I would not be here. And therefore it's all more than worth it. And that it's so beautiful to think of the fact that the time that we're here is very short, compared to the eternity that we were made for. And like you said, Angie, when you like see those, like, those moments where truth or light just pierces through and you have just a taste of reality. And yeah. It's so incredibly, like, it's this satisfaction, and it's a consolation that really does, like you said, is very, very hopeful. I also find it hopeful, despite the fact that I see myself in all of these characters, that because they're outside of you, you can see the thing they need to do really, really clearly. You know, like, I'm like, oh, if you could just do that, you know? And so maybe far more clearly than you can see in your own life, the very thing that you need to do. And so that's why this fantasy is so good. There's a line on 71 that he says, when I think the narrator was asking, like, does anybody actually stay? Like, I'm not seeing anybody staying. Mm-hmm. And he says, there's always something they insist on keeping, even at the price of misery. And that's so me. You know, there's always something that you insist on keeping for yourself, one little corner that you don't surrender of your life, or comfort that you cling to over the Lord. And you know that it's not good for you, You know that it's not bringing you anywhere closer to the Lord, and yet we insist upon it despite the stakes that are in front of us. Mm-hmm. Can we look at 75? Because it's my favorite part of the whole book.
Yes.
It's the one that I quote incessantly to everyone everywhere. I hope that you guys also have it starred in your books.
I have nothing underlined on 75, so I'm so excited.
Oh, I do. I do.
Anyway, okay.
Yes, that's what I had to.
Okay.
Rachel, it's probably just in your other copy.
Yes,
this is
true. That's where it was.
Fun fact, I was searching for this book for about 15 minutes before this. I was like, where is it? And he just found it in like a stack of books. He's like, here it is.
So it says, but what of the poor ghosts who never get to the omnibus at all? And the George MacDonald character answers, everyone who wishes it does, never fear. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, thy will be done. And those to whom God says in the end, thy will be done. All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek find. To those who knock, it is opened. I mean,
come on.
And there's no fear. You know, to those who knock, it will be opened. But it's asking the Lord to do it, right? Lord, thy will be done in me. And I see myself in all of these characters, but thy will be done in me. Mm-hmm. Not one of those characters showed up and they were like, I've got it all together and I'm ready to go. Mm-hmm. You know, like, let's do this. And like the ones who did chose themselves over going into heaven. But it's like, but thy will be done, Lord.
It's such a comforting and a challenging quote. And I love that in the middle of it, it's got the never fear, because I think that the character, the narrator at this point, was having a hard time at what he was seeing. Like he was having a hard time with the fact that, you know, even the next person that shows up, the garrulous woman, the grumbler, you know, she shows up and the narrator is having a hard time being like, why? Like, she just seems like kind of a grouchy old lady. She doesn't seem to be the type of person that should merit damnation. It seems a little much to me. And so the George MacDonald character really breaks open. No, anyone that is pursuing joy persistently will not be lost. And everyone is making this choice for themselves. And with that woman in particular, I thought he really, I was having a hard time with that one too. But then when the George MacDonald character talks about her, he opens up like, you know, has she turned in on herself so much that she's not just like a grumbler? She is a grumble, you know, that.
Yeah, that really struck me. Mm-hmm. Like she had become what she had been doing.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. She's a grumble.
Yeah. Which is like, but he said if there was like an ember, like the tiniest spark within her left of, you know, maybe the divine life or just any desire for joy left in her, we will blow on it until it like catches fire. Like, don't fear. If there's anything in her that has a desire to come along, she mm-hmm. will be able to, and we'll help her do it. Mm-hmm. You know, that to me is this beautiful image in these saints that come down. You know, you think of our saint friends, you think of the intercessions of, you know, the Padre Pio's and the, you know, St. Clair's and the whomever you really ask for their intercession, like that they're a huge aid mm-hmm. in this journey. I love thinking about that. You know, the fact that there are people that are up there rooting for us even now as we make these choices and praying for us even now as we make these choices and depicted so beautifully here. How they come and they meet them and tell them and basically say like, if there's anything at all, we can work with it.
Yeah. Like it reminds me of searching for and maintaining peace, like that, even that goodwill that remained, like whatever it is that remained, like whatever is there, like we're willing to work with you and we're able to help you and carry you. I do love how they are these images of the saints helping us.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
And how they're people. And then, you know, you get George MacDonald, who's this real character. It like really puts some like, I don't know, meat onto it for me, that it's this person that really meant something to C.S. Lewis. Like he rendered himself vulnerable in this book in this way. Mm-hmm. It is so saintly. It feels really comforting to know mm-hmm. that it's tangible, real people.
I don't want to be like the thing that I hate, like to become the thing that you hate, like the grumble. Yeah. I was like, I just don't want to become that. Like she mm-hmm. became what she hated to do, but she mm-hmm. was just like, it became who she was.
But did she hate to do it? That's the thing. Did she hate to do it?
Or because did she just do it?
I think she just did it and like then just decided that was the right thing to do is to grumble.
It became who she was.
It became who she was. And yeah. I think that I think, you know, that it's a good thing when you sit back and I would just assume it's a good thing when you sit back and say, like, oh man, like I just don't want to become that. Like, man, I'm struggling with impatience, but I don't want to become, mm-hmm. you know, a quick temper itself or dominated by XYZ. And I think that that's like the bloody dog of goodwill that we've, you know, talked about before that Zandra talks about. It's like, well, it's just that one bloody dog of goodwill that won't die, that spark that can be blown into a fire.
But so. it's such virtue ethics, right? That the things that we routinely do become who we are.
Yeah.
And, you know, that if you are the type of person who routinely, you know, tells little white lies or is dishonest in little things, mm-hmm. that when it comes to the big thing, you'll be much more likely to kind of by muscle memory, yeah. be dishonest in something large. And on the other side of that, you know, that if you just practice relentless honesty in everything, that heroic honesty is possible. And so, like we've been saying, the little steps along this way are cultivating the types of people that they are, and the patterns of their behavior are incredibly difficult to snap out of, as we know so well. But yeah, that one was really hard to take because, you know, I can slip into some complaining too, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. but you don't want to think that that would become such a way that you look at the world that it would just be your default. Mm-hmm. You know, it would just be kind of the air that you breathe. There was a Lenten challenge or something that a friend and I did one year that was like, don't complain, not even once for mm. all of Lent, and to just catch yourself to do in doing that. It was transformative.
Oh.
And you would have to self-correct, you know, or do like some little discipline every time you did. I would like cross myself or just kind of, you know, acknowledge it and say like, oh man, how many times a day am I doing that?
Yeah, that's
I'm
so
slipping
good.
Into yeah. it. Yeah. It was transformative. It was a lot.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the artist? Did you guys like the artist? Did the artist do anything for you? I really liked the artist.
You know, I think the artist was so interesting because he introduced a new kind of attachment. This is a book of attachments. The idolization of doing the thing for the sake of the fame versus doing the thing for the sake of beauty, because inspired by beauty, which is a very subtle snare that can come in on endeavors. Like, you know, he starts out with something so good because he loved, you know, the landscape, because he loved the sunrise. Then it became like he painted because he painted, and it was like the sunrise was there for the sake of painting rather than painting there for the sake of the beauty.
And then the notoriety that comes with it, you know, the thing that ends up like sending him running back to the bus was the idea that he'd been forgotten.
Yeah.
That he was out of vogue and something had to be done about this. I need to get some new work out so that people can appreciate what I do. One of my favorite quotes on 86 about this, when he's talking to a fellow painter, he's talking about like, oh, will I get to see Cézanne? Is Monet up there? Questions I would also have. Love to meet Monet. And he's like, I don't know. He might be. I haven't really gotten that far yet into heaven. And he's like, but surely in the case of distinguished people, you'd hear if they were here.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, but they're not distinguished. No more than anyone else. Don't you understand? And this is, here it is. The glory flows into everyone and back from everyone, like light and mirrors, but the light's the thing.
Mm.
I get goosebumps because it's the difference. And we all tend towards this, and maybe the things that we do well, is it for the glory of God?
Mm.
Is it to reflect him in as pure a way as his gifts have given us to do? Or is it for ourselves?
It also kind of made me think, I remember reading that part and it made me think about how St. Paul talks about like we are one body with many parts. We've got to be content with the fact that not everybody's going to have the same gifts, and not everybody's going to have, we're undistinguished. We're all one. And it's because Christ the head is the one who's pouring his life into us. And there's no need for envy or jealousy or comparison or prestige or name. Like, I love that. That's why there's a monastery that I did a silent retreat at a few years ago, and all of the graves are just a little nameless cross of all of the monks. They're just going, no name. And that's like the, you know, final act kind of humility on this earth. Yeah, I honestly don't remember where they're buried or, you know, they're all with the Lord. And that's the point. It's like coming back at the anti-distinguishment and the anti, you know, place getting and favoritism and
the giving up of your work. The giving up of your work.
Yeah.
Giving it up. Like in this place, we have no use for those things anymore.
Yeah.
I thought it was.
So go ahead.
Oh, no. I just thought the quote that you shared was interesting because on page 84, right before that, the spirit said to him, he says, no, you're forgetting. So the spirit, that was not how you began. So the artist was talking about how he was in, you know, had become so into the work itself. Light itself, this is the spirit, light itself was your first love. You loved paint only as a means of telling about light. Mm-hmm. And then later he says that quote about how the light shines through each mm-hmm. person here, that there's no distinction of who or the famous or, but I thought light itself was your first love. And so that surrendering of our work and the things that we hold on to and pride ourselves in and what we do, that our first love is the Lord. Our first love, mm-hmm. you know, comes from Christ. Yeah. And surrendering that to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think of the Blessed Mother, of course, at this moment, mm-hmm. you know, and especially how the illusion of Christ being the sun and her being the moon that reflects his light. And this is perfect example of complete and total submission to the Lord's will is so inspiring. Whereas, you know, oftentimes we're striving so hard to do that good thing that the good thing becomes the thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everyone known by God is famous. I thought that was somewhere yeah. kind of said that, like, if you're known by him, if you're held in the mind of, and it was like a capital M mind, you know, then you're famous enough.
Yeah.
That's great.
All right. I don't want to deal with this lady in chapter 10. She makes me uncomfortable.
She, the nagging.
So this is the one I don't identify at all. Robert.
Oh, poor Robert.
She like, I read this and I was like exhausted by her. Oh, and yeah. I was like, I don't want to be around her. I don't want to be anything like her. I'm finding similarities in her that I don't like.
I don't want to read anymore. Like,
If he had like fun writing that one though, you know, like you think about C.S. Lewis just like writing The Nagging Wife, and it was like, was that fun? That could have been really fun.
Oh, do you know that the ghost talks the entire chapter? The spirit or the saint,
oh wow,
gets in two interrupted sentences in the entire chapter, and they're on the first page. I went back and I noticed that. I was like, did like anything actually come out of the mouth? Like, she would not stop. I mean, it was just such a mirror of the demeanor.
What were the words?
So in the very beginning of chapter 10, it says,
is it the she spirit?
It basically says,
like, she doesn't,
the she spirit, but I don't understand. And then it was like, and slightly before, it's like, but if you've forgiven him, surely. And then like she interrupts.
Every time, like, there was interrupted.
Yeah. And she says, I forgive him as a Christian. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay. And it was really uncomfortable to read. I'm just gonna say that of the whole book, this one like really hurts to read, because it's like you see the internal dialogue of someone just spiraling out of control into so many places that you don't want to be familiar. And you see this character that is in heaven, praise the Lord, and is looking back on all of this and saying, praise the Lord, but who was so manipulated and hurt in life by her. I just feel really bad for Robert.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robert sounds like he's in a better place. So
that's true. Rob is okay.
He's all right.
Thank God for Robert.
Yeah. Well, this is the first time that we see someone actually make their final choice. Because at the very end, it says, the ghost, which had towered up like a dying candle flame, snapped suddenly, and a sour, dry smell lingered in the air for a moment, and then there was no ghost to be seen. So she basically, this kind of talks about how she renders herself into nothingness. And it's because she really just wants to control this other person, to completely use him to get what she wants. That's it. I mean, it's
complete use of a human being for whatever she thinks he should be, and her celebrating of her efforts in clearly turning a person into misery on earth.
I think too, with her, the fact that she thought she was helping him and she thought that she was doing him a favor and that he needed her. There's a lot of things in that where it's very manipulative, and it's very tons of pride in that, but also just the lack of being able to see the other person's needs. We've been talking a lot about being seen by others, and that first woman, she didn't want to be actually like seen in her vulnerability. And then this lady, she doesn't want to see her spouse for who he is and what he needs. And there's just a total blindness. And she's like, she's literally has cataracts on her entire life and is never looking at other. So then when she is faced in heaven with the choice to see the ultimate other, God, she's not even able to. She's not even able to identify that there is other, because she wasn't practicing seeing other in life. And that's what really struck me.
She's really taking on the role of creator in a very inappropriate way in this relationship, you know, where she's got a vision of who he should be.
Yeah.
And it's her job to put him through the right circumstances to arrive at that goal. I mean, when she runs off his friends, when she pushes him to work, you know, whatever, 14-hour days, when she buys the bigger house, you know, it's this earthly sort of Eden she's trying to build with these raw materials of a man. And it's just very disordered, and it's so incredibly controlling. And then she gets to heaven and starts to make demands on heaven in another way. Like, I can keep creating here. My vision was not yet complete with this man. Let me help y'all get him where he should be. Give him back into my control.
You know, it's interesting. I think this can play out in so many relationships. And one of them, I think that I know that I would be more inclined to at this point in my life that I need to examine, is if I'm doing this with my kids. I think that's something that maybe isn't necessarily the play out between spouses. Could it be the play out between mother and children? Because there's a real temptation there to want to control our kids, to muster them up and to kind of create them ourselves versus sit back. And I've been, you know, reflecting this year on sitting back and appreciating the creation that is in front of me and my children. And I have to, there are so many times I have to just sit back and remind myself of that, because I'm still struggling with this woundedness in my own heart of not recognizing the good of the other, who it's the other who's created differently than I am. And yet it's been given to me in my care, but not my control. I think that that's something to examine. The antithesis of that being seeing my job as receiver of the other and then also nurturer, but that all of it goes back to the Lord and a constant. I need to remember this every morning. It's like, it's all about giving back to the Lord, giving them back to the Lord. I don't know. I haven't totally fleshed that out yet, but as I'm sitting here and I was like, just closing my eyes as you guys were talking and thinking about this, especially what you said, Angela, about like her unwillingness to see the other. And I think about that with my kids, of like always being willing and open and remembering that the Lord's inviting me into seeing them as they are versus trying to control them. Because of the lack of trust or insecurity or fear of their future or whatever that might be.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. I was thinking, I had a good conversation with Katrina last night, Traub sister, Angela's sister. And she was talking about, we were reflecting on how sometimes we may even make idols out of our vocations and start to see ourselves primarily in that function and not firstly oriented towards Christ. And I think that this, you see that here, where she kind of ran with a vocational image of what she was supposed to do. And it was really disordered. It was not oriented towards the Lord. And how oftentimes when we are practicing modern idolatry, we're not putting something bad in the place of God. We're putting something good in the place of God. And we're just out of whack in terms of our prioritization. But Rachel, when you were talking about kids, like, oh my gosh, that pierced, that went deep inside of me, because there's so many ways that we are trying to bring them along on a right path, but is that path submitted to the Lord's guidance and will? Or is it just how we would have them? And then also the, what they look like and how they behave, how much so do we see that as a reflection on us?
Yeah.
And the pride that's intermingled in that very concept is what I need to think more about for sure.
Yeah. Amen. Is it like such a purifying thing to be a parent?
Yeah,
it really is. Oh, it really is. When that lady was talking, I whole time was thinking like, oh, didn't have any kids in there. You know, it's like we were waiting for her to mention maybe that they had children, but maybe they just, you know, weren't blessed with children. But I was thinking like, you know, the purifying nature of children really does, you know, split your focus off the husband.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, I could talk about this forever, but I think that we're good. I think we've hit our time for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that this was such a good conversation. And I feel like this book continues to just be a good little mirror to hold up and say, like, I relate with this. This thing brings me hope. Yeah, I just hope that whoever's listening to this, like, maybe there's something there that the Lord's inviting you into. Thanks, ladies, for this chat.
Chitty chat. The light's the thing. That's my line from this conversation. The light's the thing.
The light is the thing.
The light is the thing.
Love it. All right. Talk next month.
Alrighty, bye.
Bye.